Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran's leader meets the Syrian president in Tehran, saying victories or Syria's victory in the years-long war has brought it respect and credibility. The German chancellor says Russia will not win the Ukraine war after the Russian president vows, quote, as in 1945, victory will be ours. Also ahead, people are voting in the Philippines to elect a new president with the son of former dictator Ferdinand Marcos more likely than rivals to win the high-stakes race. Hello and welcome from the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Thank you for joining us. Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has hailed the Syrian nation for remaining steadfast during the years-long war in the Arab country. The leader was speaking with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad here in the capital, Tehran. Ayatollah Khamenei said Syria's victory in that war has brought it respect and credibility. He also spoke about relations between Tehran and Damascus, saying that both governments are determined to further expand cooperation. The Syrian president, for his part, praised Iran for supporting his country as well as the resistance front in the region. Al-Assad also held separate talks with his Iranian counterpart, Ebrahim Raisi. They discussed regional issues and bilateral relations. Raisi said the resistance of regional countries will result in a new order in West Asia. Al-Assad said Syria's ties with Iran are strategic. The one-day trip was Assad's second visit to Tehran since war broke out in Syria in 2011. Journalist and political commentator Sayed Mohsen Abbas says the Syrian president's visit to Iran is a sign of a strategic partnership between the two sides. He explains why the visit is significant. Take a listen.
This meeting is a kind of another flag to all those who may be thinking that President Assad might loosen his alliance with Iran. Of course, the trade between Iran and Iraq is essential, about 20 billions in an annual terms there. Also translates to Syria, because of course, you know, the pathway for the Islamic Republic of Iran to Syria goes through Iraq, and of course they've got very strong alliances with the Hashd al-Shaabi and the Iraqi forces out there as well. This is a pivotal alliance which also the Israelis and the Arabs, the Zio Arabs and the Americans want to break. I think President Assad arriving in Tehran at this moment is very, very important for so many reasons. The first and foremost is declaring its ongoing partnership and friendship and strategic friendship with Iran with good reason.
The Iranian president says Tehran is adamantly opposed to expansionist policies of the Western military alliance, NATO. Ebrahim Raisi also touched upon the conflict between Ukraine and Russia, saying Iran also disapproves of war and fighting. He further told visiting Polish Foreign Minister Zbigniew Rau that Tehran-Warsaw economic and trade relations are not on a par with political relations between the two. He urged both Iran and Poland to tap into their existing industrial and economic potential to further boost bilateral ties. The top Polish diplomat in turn said the two sides enjoy numerous potentialities to forge closer ties on all fronts.
It's a warm welcome for an end to frosty ties. It's the second time in almost 3 years that Polish Foreign Minister Zbigniew Rau has visited Iran. His two-day trip began with a meeting with his Iranian counterpart, Hossein Amir Abdollahian. The talks were held behind closed doors, while the two diplomats briefed reporters on the themes of the discussions, which ranged from economic ties to the Russo-Ukrainian war.
We talked on important issues today, on potentials for economic cooperation. We also spoke about the Russian-Ukrainian conflict. I should thank Poland for hosting Ukrainian refugees in the Russian-Ukrainian war. Iran, for its part, has since day one called for a political solution to the crisis.
The Polish diplomat's trip comes on the 80th anniversary of the entry of Polish refugees into Iran during the thick of World War II. In 1942, Iran was a major landing point for some 120,000 Polish refugees who were forced out of Poland by the Soviet Union. Touching on the issue, the top Polish diplomat said Iran's hospitality created a cordial relationship between the two nations.
We are making the 80th anniversary of the exodus of Polish refugees from their land by the USSR. I should once again thank the Iranian nation who has hosted our countrymen, providing a safe haven for them for decades.
The Polish foreign minister underlined the significance of the 2015 deal in bringing peace, calling on both Iranian and American officials to arrive at an agreement as soon as possible.
Poland and Iran are looking forward to the success of the negotiations over the 2015 deal. When that happens, we will start extensive economic cooperation with Iran without worries over the sanctions.
Iran sits on a geostrategically important part of Eastern Europe. It could act as a gateway for Iran to trade with other European states. Iran, for its part, can also act as a gateway for Polish trade with the Middle East. The two sides cited lack of knowledge as the main reason behind their low trade, hoping that this trip will set the start for broader economic ties.
After decades of uneventful relations, Tehran and Warsaw are now determined to begin a new chapter in their ties. And this last visit by the Polish foreign minister is seen as the first step towards stronger ties between the two countries, something which could redefine the course of many unresolved issues, from the fate of the 2015 deal to Iran's ties with the West. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Moving on, Israel pushes ahead with its atrocities against Palestinians. The regime's forces have killed three more Palestinians in three separate attacks across the occupied West Bank. One victim, Mahmoud Sami Aram, succumbed to his wounds after a shot near the city of Tul Karim. The Israeli army claimed he was trying to cross a barrier separating the occupied territories. Another Palestinian was killed in Al-Quds over the allegation that he tried to stab an Israeli officer. And a third person was shot dead in a settlement near Bethlehem. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has denounced the killing, saying they reveal that the regime is gripped by fear. Separately, the Palestinian foreign ministry condemned Israeli crimes in the occupied land. Tel Aviv has intensified raids and bloody crackdown following Palestinian operations in recent weeks that left over a dozen Israelis dead.
Days after launching a massive manhunt across the occupied territories, Israeli military forces arrested the two Palestinian youths who carried out Thursday's deadly operation in the settlement of Elad that was established on the Palestinian village of Mzera, central Israel. 19-year-old Asad Arifai and 20-year-old Subhi Sbihat were arrested in a forest near Elad. Israeli military forces, Israel's intelligence agency, and Israeli police all took part in the manhunt.
The two heroes were arrested, but we affirm that they carried out a special operation, a move that has made Palestinians feel proud. The Israeli regime mobilized all human, logistical, and technological capabilities to arrest the two youths. The Israeli military establishment will try to use their capture and publish the videos of their arrest to cover its security failure. But those two proved that the Israeli security is fragile.
Immediately following Thursday's operation that left three Israeli settlers dead and four others wounded, Israeli military took a number of decisions. First, family members of the two youths, who are from the village of Rumani near Jenin in northern occupied West Bank, were arrested and interrogated, in addition to many others close to them. Experts now say the second step would be demolishing their homes as part of the collective punishment Israel imposes in such incidents. Israel urges the move is a deterrence act to force Palestinians to quit resistance.
It's one form of the collective punishment adopted by the Israeli regime. They think these punishments will stop Palestinians or prevent their operations. Israel knows very well it has failed to prevent such operations, and we can see that the Palestinian resistance continues and even has gained momentum.
A number of Israeli legislators and experts have promoted for killing senior Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar in response to the current wave of operations, which he has encouraged. Meanwhile, the group's military wing issued a threat for an unprecedented response and a regional earthquake should Israel attempt to harm any of its top leadership, especially Yahya Sinwar. From day one, it was crystal clear for Palestinians that the two youths would be either arrested or killed by the Israeli forces. Palestinians say what the two have done was part of their legitimate resistance. They add the operation was a heroic move and in retaliation for the Israeli crimes and the settlers' incursions into the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Lebanese citizens living abroad cast their ballots in the country's parliamentary election. Around 200,000 Lebanese expatriates in 48 countries are eligible to vote. On Friday, those living in Iran and several Arab countries cast their ballots in their diplomatic missions. The ballot boxes will be sent to Lebanon and stored at the central bank before being counted on the election day. On May the 15th, voters inside Lebanon will head to the polls. The elect come amid an unprecedented economic crisis that began in 2019, leading to the currency collapse and plunging over 70% of the population into poverty. The last election held in 2018, the Hezbollah resistance movement and its allies won majority seats. The Hezbollah chief blames the crisis on a U.S.-led conspiracy against his country. Russia is celebrating Victory Day, an annual event to mark the defeat of Nazi Germany in World War II. The occasion takes on new importance for Russia because of its war in Ukraine, with President Vladimir Putin vowing, quote, as in 1945, victory will be ours. Ahead of the event, the Russian leader said Ukraine is in the grip of fascism and that Nazism is nearing its head, or rearing its head, I should say, once more. He called it a sacred duty to take revenge on successors of those who were defeated decades ago. He, however, wished all Ukrainians a peaceful and just future. Russia has repeatedly insisted that its military offensive in Ukraine, launched on February the 24th, is to demilitarize and denazify its neighbor. Meanwhile, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz says his country would support Ukraine in its war with Russia.
Ukrainians will not accept this, and neither will we. Rarely have we stood as united with our friends and partners as we do today. I am deeply convinced that Putin will not win the war. Ukraine will persist. Freedom and security will triumph. Just as freedom and security triumphed over a lack of freedom, violence and dictatorship 77 years ago.
Scholz said the outcome of the war would not be a Russian-dictated peace in Ukraine. He claimed Putin wants to subjugate Ukraine, destroy its culture and identity. He also accused the Russian leader of distorting history by, quote, equating his barbaric war of aggression with the fight against National Socialism. He said Germany has sent, a large cache of weapons to Ukraine to help it fight against Russia. The United States and its allies impose more sanctions on Russia in response to its war on Ukraine. The leaders of the Group of Seven Nations say they would phase out or ban the import of Russian oil in a timely and orderly fashion. The European Union also echoed the call by saying the 27-nation bloc is getting closer to agreeing tough sanctions against Russia that include a ban on oil purchase. However, the bloc faces a challenge to secure oil supplies to landlocked Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic, which all depend heavily on Russian crude. Meanwhile, the United States said it had imposed sanctions on 27 executives from Russia's gas exporter, Gazprom Bank, and three Russian television networks. Washington also imposed visa restrictions on more than 2,500 members of Russia's military, while sanctioning eight Russian maritime companies and nearly 70 vessels. Ukrainian forces trapped inside a steel plant in the now Russia-controlled city of Mariupol say they will not surrender, vowing to fight on. A top Ukrainian officer says the troops have limited supplies but enough munitions to respond, adding that surrender is not an option. He said they have witnessed war crimes committed by Russian forces in the port city. He added the Ukrainian forces will not abandon their injured colleagues. The steel plant is the last pocket of Ukrainian resistance in the city. Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said 60 people were killed in the Russian bombing of a school in the country's east. According to Ukrainian officials, the school sheltering about 90 people was hit on Saturday, causing a fire that engulfed the building. Sweden and Finland are expected to announce their bid to officially apply to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, also known as NATO. The move has infuriated Moscow and could see the Baltic region become much more militarized. Robert Carter explores whether the move would actually benefit Sweden and Finland at all in the following report.
NATO's hopes of securing two new additions to its military alliance are close to becoming reality, as the historically neutral Nordic countries, Sweden and Finland, take serious steps towards applying for membership. The Scandinavian powers' interest in joining spiked after Russia's military operation in Ukraine began. Just the idea of a NATO expansion northwards has sparked a furious Russian response.
Both the US and NATO have made abundantly clear that they are very keen to see the two new Nordic additions to the bloc. However, with Sweden and Finland's long history of neutrality seeming to serve them very well until now, is joining the military alliance truly beneficial to their national and regional security?
NATO members, including the UK, US, France and Germany, have been applying pressure to secure the two additions. Moscow has repeatedly warned of serious consequences if Finland and Sweden join NATO, saying it would strengthen its land, naval and air forces in the Baltic Sea and even raise the possibility of deploying nuclear weapons in the area.
But what NATO is doing is to pull increasing numbers of countries within its orbit, either as direct members or as associate members, and that this then ties them to a whole number of things which they may not want to do in the future. The consequences of the end of this neutrality will not be more safety for any country in Eastern Europe. It will be an increase in the arms race on both sides. It will be an increase in military presence in those countries and elsewhere. So this is a road that people should think very, very carefully before they go down.
The coming days are crucial. Finland will decide to apply for membership by May the 12th, while Sweden, the less enthusiastic of the two, is conducting a security policy review, including the pros and cons of joining the alliance. The results are due on May the 13th. If both decide yes, the process of joining will be swift, but so too could Russia's response. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Refusing a windfall tax is a political choice which shows the Tories aren't on the side of the British people. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Andrea Germanos, journalist. This article is published under the heading Grotesque. BP enjoys largest profits in decade as Boris Johnson rejects windfall tax. Stay tuned for more. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Conservative government came under fire recently for its refusal to impose a windfall tax on oil and gas giants after BP posted its highest quarterly earnings in more than a decade. The London-headquartered energy company announced an underlying replacement cost profit of $6.2 billion for the first 3 months of 2022, well above the $2.6 billion it posted the same period last year and beating the $4.5 billion expected by market analysts. BP attributed the profit to exceptional oil and gas trading, higher oil realizations, and a stronger refining result, and announced plans to buy back an additional $2.5 billion in shares. The company also said it wrote its $25 billion stake in Russia to zero. The Guardian reported last week, looked at one way, that's a lot of money. Looked at another, it's practically chicken feed for a company that absorbed 50 billion pounds of costs from its 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill and lived to tell the tale. Moreover, the loss might have been more painful if it weren't for the fact that oil companies have been making out like bandits due to sky-high oil and gas prices. While Chancellor of the Exchequer Rishi Sunak suggested last week that a windfall tax on energy companies could happen if the firms are not going to make investments in our country and energy security, Business Secretary Kasi Kartang made clear that he's never been a supporter of windfall taxes, declaring, "I think it discourages investment." In an interview following BP's posting, the Prime Minister doubled down on that assertion. Good Morning Britain host Susanna Reid pressed Johnson about his refusal to support a windfall tax on energy companies to help UK households facing soaring prices for food, petrol, and other necessities. The Prime Minister claimed, if you put a windfall tax on the energy companies, what that means is that you discourage them from making the investments that we want to see that will, in the end, keep energy prices lower for everybody. But Ed Miliband, the opposition Labour Party's climate secretary and an MP for Doncaster North, took issue with Johnson's assertion. The government claims that the massive profits windfall is going to investment. Miliband tweeted, adding, BP tells us in black and white that's wrong. They say 60% is going to share buybacks. He added, refusing a windfall tax is a political choice which shows the Tories aren't on the side of the British people. Green MP for Brighton Pavilion Caroline Lucas similarly criticized Johnson's rejection of a windfall tax. She tweeted, soaring gas prices mean BP profits of $6.2 billion in first 3 months of 2022, while millions struggle to make ends meet. Lucas added that the government's refusal to levy a windfall tax on obscene profits and support those with huge energy bills shows whose side they are on. It's grotesque. Criticism also flew in from climate campaigners, including Friends of the Earth. It's astonishing, said FOE energy campaigner Sana Yusuf, adding that companies like BP are allowed to rake in huge profits while people up and down the country are struggling with soaring energy bills. The campaigner also urged Sunak introduce a windfall tax that funds investment in a nationwide energy efficiency program. She said, a street-by-street insulation program targeting the hardest-hit first Would lower bills help manage energy demand and improve energy security? With profits like this, it would be short-sighted to do anything less. Calls from progressive lawmakers and groups in the U.S. for a windfall tax on oil and gas companies have also gone unheeded.
Food for thought.
Salam, dear listeners, and let us start the day with a thought-provoking statement from Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, on the threshold of the anniversary of the criminal desecration of the sacred Jannatul Baqi cemetery of Medina by the Wahhabi heretics. Preserve the graves, the rights of whose people are obligatory upon you, and visit them and seek earnings there, because the dead will be delighted if you visit them. You should ask your needs near the graves of your parents after supplicating to God for them.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum rahmatullahi wa barakatuh to your listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa Al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic beliefs. Joining me in the studio today is our dear friend and guest speaker Sheikh Nur Muhammad from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. We have, as you know, dear Sheikh, and as our dear listeners know, we have many narrations, and these narrations, we use them to create Islamic laws, and basically they are the fundament of Islam along with the Holy Quran. And we have narrations who have been related by trusted and authoritative and authenticated narrators, many famous of them, some Shia, some non-Shia. One such figure who has related many narrations is Abu Huraira. So as Shia Muslims, what is our Shia Islamic view of Abu Huraira? Was he, as some Muslims claim, that he was one of the great companions of the Prophet, peace be upon him and his family? And by extensions, why are most narrations, according to this listener, related from him?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's talking about Abu Huraira. First of all, the complete name of this person was Abdullah or Abdurrahman. We have two quotation here. Bin Amir aw bin Sakhr, who was passed away in 59 after Hijrah. And, in the time of the noble prophets, of course, I have to mention in the beginning, because it is very important for having the analysis, a scholarly analysis of the and Rajali critics, which means that if you want to understand whether that specific person is authentic one or not, you have to go to the Ilm al-Rajal, which deal with the chain of the narrators.
Right.
Chain of the narration.
The chain of transmission. Right.
Yes, the transmission, which we call it the sanad, which is the chain of the narration. And you go to the single by single person and try to analyze and to have kind of critics
right.
about that person to find it out whether that person is a reliable one or not.
Right.
According to that, he embraced Islam 4 years before the demise of Noble Prophet. Please notice, 4 years before the demise, only 4 years of Noble Prophet.
He was a new Muslim then.
He was very new Muslim, converted to Islam. But on the other hand, you find that more than 5,000 narrations he has narrated from the, of course, Noble Prophet, and maybe from other, I want to say that different version of the narration, whether he was into the chain of the narration, and after all, he quoted more than 5,000 narrations.
MashaAllah, he has a very good memory, dear Sheikh.
Very good memory, and you can find, and maybe we have another, understanding that is that possible that only you have 4 years before the demise of the Noble Prophet? How could you have these kinds of huge number of the narration? And this
right.
is a first step and first scholarly doubt about the authenticity of some portion of his narrations. If you look at the other companions, and maybe older than him, for
right.
example, much before than Abu Huraira, they quoted few narrations. You cannot do any comparison between his, quantity wise.
Right.
You cannot do a comparison between his quotation and other companions' quotation. This is a first very heavy doubt about
right.
the authenticity.
So too many narrations in too little time.
Yeah. Talking a little bit about his biography, he was sent by the Noble Prophet in the last year of the life of the Noble Prophet by the companions of the by the companionship of Ala ibn Hadrami to Bahrain in that time. And of course, in the time of the second caliph, he was blamed by him because of gathering a lot of money and wealth.
Interesting. He was too rich.
He was too rich because he was sent as a governor over there.
Right.
And especially after the time of the first and second caliphs. First of all, by the Noble Prophet, he was sent over there. But, it remained there by the time of the first and second caliph, and he was blamed by the second caliph for having a lot of wealth. He was real staunch supporter of third caliph Uthman,
right.
And in the time of the siege of his house, he was present over there in the house of Uthman, and he was a supporter of Muawiyah in his time. And he was one of the close friends of Marwan ibn Hakam, the governor of Medina, in the time of Muawiyah. This was a little biography. For further study, you can go to the book of Abu Huraira, written by Abdul Hussein Sharafuddin, and of course other books talking about his biography. The point that I want to mention, that you can guess by this very quick biography of Abu Huraira, you can guess how about the reliability of his narration, at least some parts of his narration, whether they are the authentic one or not. But we have the narration from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wassalam. It has been attributed to him. He said that أَكْذَبُ الْأَهْيَاءَ عَلَىٰ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam Abu Huraira ad-Dawsi. I think it's end of his story, right, if we accept the authenticity of this narration from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wa sallam. He said that the one of the obvious, you know, liars and who ascribe lie to the noble prophet, who fabricate hadiths to the noble prophet, is Abu Huraira.
End of story.
Yes, end of story if we accept the authenticity of this narration. So I want to say that at least we can say that the some portion of his narrations are not acceptable and accurate. According to the science and the science of Rijal, you should look whether the narration that Abu Huraira has quoted, whether has been quoted by other narrators or not.
Right.
If the same content have been quoted by other narrators who are reliable one, okay, in that case, you can accept the idea and you can accept the content of that narration. But in a time and in a case that only Abu Huraira is quoting this narration, maybe we have some, you should take it with a grain of salt.
Maybe a kilogram of salt. Just be suspicious. So and would we say that he was one of the great companions of the Prophet then?
Maybe, you know, at least we can say that he was one of the companions of noble Prophet. And please be careful that according to Ahlul Sunnah, they believe in the idala and the justice of all companions of the noble Prophet.
Right.
And maybe this idea of our brothers of Ahlul Sunnah, they caused them to stop having further study and, you know, having analytical understanding of the... of the companions of noble prophet. But according to Shia school of thought, we do not have same. Of course, we respect at least we respect the companions of the noble prophet. But we have the scholarly critics about the companions of noble prophet, and sometimes we criticize them according, of course, to the basis that we have some information that we have.
So from a scholarly point of view, he's not a trusted source of information, of narration.
Yes. As I said, if he is single-handedly, he has quoted one narration, we should take it with a grain of salt.
Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Then perhaps I'm going to ask maybe a provocative question then. What is his stance on the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them? Was he a friend, a supporter, or was he an enemy, or did he not care about them at all?
We have different, quotation according to the, that my study that I have. Sometimes he was supporting some ideas and, some of the fada'il of Ahlul Bayt, some of the positive traits of Ahlul Bayt. But after all, he was not a, generally speaking, he was not supporters of the Ahlul Bayt. And sometimes he withdraw supporting the rights of the Ahlul Bayt. Yeah.
So, dear Sheikh, Abu Huraira is just one such narrator. We have other narrators And for Shia Muslims who perhaps they're not scholars, they're not Islamic scholars, they do not study in the seminary, how can they differentiate between which narrator or which narration they can listen to and take from and act upon, and which narration that they should leave and not learn from?
You see that if you want to do that, you should go to the scholar of Rijal and Diraya. Let me explain very briefly. Rijal, I explain what does it mean.
Yes.
But Diraya is to analyze the, you know, complete version of the narration, whether this narration, after all, is Sahih, Hasan, Muwaffaq, or Da'if, or different categorization and classification that we have for the narrations. I want to say that if you want to accept the narration or refute it, you should go to the scholar. You should go to the experts who are qualified people. And you cannot yourself, without any already study, go and, you know, faith with the, you know, go and have the narration and try to, for example, benefit from them. It is not acceptable one, yes.
Right. So at the end of the day, we say to our brothers in faith, ask your local scholar or for advice, what I can read, because at the end of the day, they know the society that they reside in best, and they can guide you, inshallah. We will end today's program because we are out of time. I thank the dear Sheikh for joining us and for sharing with us his knowledge, and I also thank the listeners for tuning in. Until next time, fi amanillah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
Cultural news. Social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
The third long duration team of astronauts launched by SpaceX to the International Space Station, ISS, for NASA safely departed the orbiting outpost to begin their descent back to Earth, capping a six-month science mission. Live video showing the capsule drifting away from the station as the two vehicles soared high over Australia was shown on a NASA webcast. Wearing helmeted white and black spacesuits, the four astronauts were seen strapped into the crew cabin shortly before the spacecraft separated from the station, orbiting some 400 kilometers above the Earth. NASA said one of the cosmonauts, Oleg Artemyev, assumed command of the ISS from Marsburn in a handover before Thursday's undocking.
And I relinquish control of the or command of the space station to you.
I accept command. I accept command. Thank you for here. Thank you for friendship. It was unbelievable time to go.
If all goes smoothly, the Crew Dragon craft, dubbed Endurance, will parachute into the sea off the coast of Florida on Friday. Their departure came about a week after they welcomed their replacement team aboard the station, also currently home to three Russian cosmonauts on a long-term mission. Chinese scientists are establishing a meteorological monitoring station at an altitude of 8,800 meters on Mount Komolangma, the world's highest peak on the China-Nepal border. The 13 members of the research team started the trek towards an 8,300-meter base camp on Mount Komolangma from a 7,028-meter camp on Tuesday morning. They reached the camp in the afternoon and went on the last section of the arduous journey up on Wednesday morning. If the station is established successfully, it will replace the one at an altitude of 8,430 meters set up by the British and U.S. scientists on the mountains in 2019. It will be the world's highest of its kind, according to the Chinese Academy of Sciences. Iran's capital, Tehran, is hosting the country's most high-profile robotics event, dubbed RoboCop Iran Open. The event seeks to promote robotics and artificial intelligence by holding tournaments. Yusuf Shalali has the story.
They may not be able to face human soccer players just yet, but these robot footballers are taking their baby steps toward achieving this goal. The 16th edition of RoboCop Iran Open brought together 100 teams from across the country to compete in different fields of robotics and artificial intelligence, with a focus on soccer robots.
Our robot is a soccer player that moves with its wheels. It's totally different from humanoid robots, but it can certainly challenge them and beat them in a football match.
We have taken part in the Maze League of the RoboCop games. It's the first time I'm involved in this big competition where I have to implement all my programming, mechanics and electronics skills to win the game. I'm so excited.
Organizers say RoboCop seeks to promote robotics and artificial intelligence by offering IT experts a real-time challenge to build the most capable robots.
The idea of RoboCop competitions is to increase the creativity of IT experts in developing efficient robots. Why soccer? Because first of all, it is a highly popular sport, and second, it is a highly strategic game that requires a robot to perform many difficult tasks, which, if accomplished, can turn them into strong and capable robots.
RoboCop Iran Open is part of the international initiative dubbed Robot Soccer World Cup, or shortly, RoboCop. The event was first launched in 1997 and was inspired by the victory of a computer chess player against the then world chess champion, Garry Kasparov. The official goal of the competition, as stated by its organizers, is to hone the capabilities of humanoid robot soccer players so that they will win a soccer game against the winner of the most recent FIFA World Cup in mid-21st century.
While robots still have a long way to go before they can challenge the likes of Messi and Ronaldo, the ultimate goal of RoboCop is not about robot footballers beating human rivals, but the technology advances that can be made along the way to improve our lives. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
There is a lot to be worried about when it comes to the climate. An Indian auto rickshaw driver in the capital, New Delhi, has come up with an innovative idea to beat the scorching heat wave. He has built a garden on the roof of his vehicle to keep passengers cool. Mahendra Kumar's vehicle, dubbed Moving Garden, stands out among others with its unique rooftop. He has grown vegetables, flowers and a variety of herbs and shrubs on the small roof space. Kumar says it was easy to make the garden by spreading a thick sack over a mat and covering it with soil. Then he added the plants, watered them, and watched them grow.
Around 2 years ago, I had this idea during the peak of the summer season. I thought if I can grow some plants on the roof, it will keep my auto rickshaw cool and give relief from the heat to my passengers.
Kumar says the thick green keeps his three-wheeler cool even when temperatures reach 45 degrees Celsius. The rickshaw driver has also installed small fans inside for the comfort of passengers as an extra measure. His passengers say they feel cold because of the natural air conditioner. Kumar's rickshaw attracts many commuters for obvious reasons, and passers-by also stop to take selfies.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A museum in France is hosting Treasures of Peru, including the famed Machu Picchu, in a unique experience where technology meets archaeology. Visitors can immerse themselves in a vertical tour of Machu Picchu Citadel and see an exclusive exhibit of Peruvian archaeological objects. The collection is arranged chronologically, passing through the extraordinary diversity of some 13 cultures. The collection displays 200 artifacts spanning three millennia, dating as far back as 1500 BC. A large part of the exhibit is dedicated to Peru's Machica civilization with their vase portraits and red ceramics. The museum's curator says the goal was to show that pre-Columbus Peru was far deeper than just the Inca era. These days, it's easier than ever to get lost in the virtual world. A unique museum in the U.S. is using augmented reality for visitors to plug into a thrilling experience about the Earth's environmental challenges. The New York Museum is called Arcadia Earth. It offers a large-scale, multisensorial journey through underwater worlds, mountains, savannas, and inspirational fantasy lands. Each exhibit is brought to life through immersive technology and animated by augmented and virtual reality, including projection mapping. One installation is made of 44,000 plastic bags, the amount used in New York every minute before a plastic bag ban was implemented. The museum founder says the goal is to raise awareness about the impacts of climate change in a fun way.
The intention is to inspire people to come and leveraging game and immersive beauty to deliver a message. And I think that if this technique were to be used in school, we will so learn much more and every kid will want to go to school. And at the end of the day, the purpose is just to deliver the message. The tools are just techniques. So I really think that this technique, it's super fun and will work for everyone.
Vittori added that the experience is meant to encourage people to be proactive in protecting the planet. The exhibit also spotlights other environmental challenges such as overfishing and food waste. Proceeds from tickets sold are used to plant mangrove trees. This exhibit has been held in several cities across the United States, and each time proceeds have been used to support various environmental causes. Appearing like something straight out of a sci-fi movie, this Gundam-style robot lifts off special equipment and carries out maintenance work on out-of-reach railway contact lines in Japan. Developed by West Japan Railway Company JR West and two other Japanese companies, the humanoid robot can conduct repair work on overhead wires, which are considered high risk for humans. According to J.R. West, a prototype of this robot can be controlled by human operators through VR helmets and remote controls. It can lift objects up to 40 kilograms in weight with two hands to a height of 10 meters. It was designed to lower the risk of electrocution and falling for workers. The company says it can cut down human labor by a third. The company has been conducting tests since April and expects to put the robot into full service by early 2024.
A child-sized doll screams and rolls its eyes while lying on a table as engineer Hiroki Takimoto looks on calmly. But instead of being a child's toy, the doll is a humanoid robot mimicking critical medical symptoms designed to train dental workers. The robot was co-developed by Japanese robotic startups TeamSock and a local dental school. Pediaroid was designed to stimulate a child's responses when receiving dental treatment, including changes to its medical condition. Using a tablet programmed with different medical conditions, the user is able to send signals to air cylinders installed within the robot's joints to move its entire body, mouth, and tongue to display physical reactions and facial expressions.
Medical workers really need to experience medical emergencies. It's important that they experience a situation where something goes wrong, and that's what it can simulate. As for the future, we would like to further develop it in such a way that various other people who are involved with childcare, such as mothers, elementary school teachers, childcare workers, and nurses, can experience emergency simulations.
Director of TeamSock's engineering division, Yusuke Ishii, said the robot was developed due to the lack of clinical dental training to treat children. Currently, at a hefty price tag of about 25 million Japanese yen, TeamSock hopes to develop the hyper-realistic robot further such that people from other childcare industries, including pediatricians and elementary school teachers, would be able to use it for other emergency situation training.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The United States has reached a grim milestone. More than 1 million Americans have now perished due to coronavirus since the pandemic began 2 years ago. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Chris Walker, journalist. This article is published under the heading U.S. surpasses 1 million COVID deaths since pandemic's start. Here's the story. The United States has reached a grim milestone. More than 1 million Americans have now perished due to coronavirus since the pandemic began 2 years ago. According to numbers compiled by NBC News, the 1 millionth death from COVID-19 in the U.S. occurred recently. Other measures vary on where the U.S. officially stands on COVID-19 deaths. The New York